What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Pinnacle Performance Podcast. Today, I have Locatelli Rao, who is a physical therapist, someone I've been interacting with quite a bit ever since I got on social media. And we've had some great conversations ranging anywhere from PRI to making shoes work for golf. And I really love how he integrates all these different systems effectively together within his own system and his physical therapy approach. So thank you very much for joining me today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man, this is going to be a lot of fun. And I'm curious, just for those who aren't familiar with you, give us a quick background on you.
Yeah, so I graduated from PT school in 2002 and basically went through that. And early on in my career, I figured out that seeing three patients every hour wasn't for me. And so I took a big leap of faith in 2004, just 2 years into my practice, and just started working for myself. Did that for a while. And then in 2009, I actually ended up getting sick. And ultimately it was determined I needed a kidney transplant. So I kind of powered along until 2015, which is when I got my transplant. And so during that time in 2013, I expanded my practice to the space I'm in now. And I don't know how I did it, but you know, on no kidneys, I basically expanded a practice to 14 employees. And after my transplant in 15, I was in quarantine like we are now, for a 3 month period, and really had a chance to reflect as to what I was doing from a business standpoint. And so slowly but surely from 15 till now, I transitioned out of all insurances, work comp, lawyers and things of that sort. And, you know, in 15 was really when I kind of started my second phase of my clinical career. Started with the Movement Links series, which is taught by Claire Frank. That's her creation. Claire is an international DNS instructor, probably one of the best. And so I started on a pretty intensive DNS journey during that time. And then slowly but surely got exposed to PRI and FRS. My first FRS introduction was FRC. And so over the course of the last five years or so, you know, I've probably attended about 10 seminars a year.
Wow.
And probably have sent out a few thousand texts to all the instructors. So I'm that guy that you don't want to give me your cell phone number, because basically I'm trying to figure this all out. And I've had the luxury of, you know, I have a lot of tricks from, you know, things from all the years that I've practiced prior to that. And so for me, it just became more of trying to figure out, you know, how it all, what is everyone really trying to do here? Mm-hmm. And so that's where I'm at now.
So in terms of gathering all this information, like synthesizing it into your own sort of approach, what do you think all of these things have in common? And what do you think these systems do that is fundamentally different?
So ultimately, what all three systems want to do is they really want to affect the nervous system. And it's masked in the form of exercise or manual inputs or things of that sort. But really, you know, if you think about, like, let's say, for example, so PRI is obviously very much centered around the autonomic nervous system, autonomics, and how that affects, you know, that I almost call it like a, It's like a cloud that hangs over us, right? So that cloud, if you're parasympathetic, if you're sympathetically driven, it's like a dark cloud.
Yeah.
That ramps you up and limits your movement variability and sleep quality, and it's really this perpetuating cycle. And when you do get to parasympathetic, that dark cloud turns white or even goes away, right? And people feel magically much better. DNS wants to tap into that subcortical system of those developmental patterns, right, that we were born with, right, that are that quote unquote hardwired into our system. And for those who've never experienced it, to go through a really good DNS session, I mean, you come out of there feeling amazing. And then of course with FRC, they want to maximize the mechanoreceptors at every single joint capsule so that your nervous system, you know, has great awareness, great afference of what's going on at every individual joint.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all affecting the nervous system just in different ways, right?
Yeah. That's an interesting way to look at it. Yeah. And I love that the cloud analogy you used for PR. It's like a little cartoon, I imagine, in my head. So
yeah, people don't realize that they're walking around with this cloud that just gets darker and darker, right?
Yeah. And as you get deeper into this, you can just kind of watch someone walk and how they carry themselves. And you can kind of go like, I know what your cloud looks like today. And you can almost see that they don't trust to put their next foot in front of themselves because they're so unstable. It's amazing. So when you're addressing people, and obviously this is such a hard question to answer because it's so contextual, but just generally speaking, when you're working with someone, when do you kind of gravitate towards one system over the other? Is there like a specific instance or like general instances where you're like, yeah, this is kind of like more of a PRI, more of a DNS, more of an FRS situation? Or do you kind of use everything with everyone?
So really the first thing that goes on, right, this is something that I learned from Claire, is, you know, the moment that person walks into your door, you're already assessing them, right? Mm-hmm. You're kind of seeing what's going on. But then most importantly, one of the things that I think is a completely underrated, underappreciated skill is the history. I mean, I've had histories. I've spent an entire hour session just taking a history down.
Mm.
And so when you take someone's history, that's really going to tell me where I might want to go with this person. But then it also depends on who that person is. So for example, if I have someone who is FRC trained, right, they can very easily communicate to me within FRC lingo, like, hey, I've got closing angle pain in my shoulder, right? And then I'll be like, okay, so we can go from there. But, you know, if I get someone who isn't familiar, you know, I can go through all my PRI tests in about 10 minutes. I can do my IAP tests in maybe 2, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's a local issue, you know, I can have them do 2 or 3 cars, right? I'll teach them, like, for example, if they got a shoulder issue, I can teach them a neck car and a shoulder car and a scapular car in less than 10 minutes, and I'll get good information off of all those. And then from there, I'll figure out where I might want to go with this person. So that's how I kind of get to where we need to go with this person.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that, obviously, like at this point, I think everyone understands that the body is connected. Everything is connected. Global approach is a way to go. So when it comes to addressing things on a global scale, like with a general, like let's say I come into you with back pain, and you see that my breathing pattern is off, my pelvis is a little bit torqued, and my range of motion is clearly limited up and down my chain. Where does your mind go in terms of like a global approach? You're going to go, well, I want to, if this person's just globally a disaster, am I going to look at their breathing first and I really want to hammer that? Where do you go if that's kind of a situation you're dealing with?
So typically it's going to come down to a diaphragm thing.
Mm.
It's going to come down to a diaphragm thing with respect to, is their breathing a disaster, like you said, right? Or sometimes if the person needs it, I will just have them focus on IAP right off the bat. You know, I hope I don't offend any of the DNS people out there with this, but, you know, without repositioning through the PRI lens, I think focusing strictly on IAP is a bandage. Mm. bandage. You know, I love IAP and that type of training at the end of someone's program, because really IAP is, in my opinion, the glue that really synchronizes movement. Mm-hmm. But before that, I think the things that are taught in PRI with respect to getting someone to alternate, reciprocate, being able to get someone from side to side, I think those things come into play first.
How would you go about training IAP?
So IAP is assessed in the world of DNS. You know, there's quite a few positions they teach that mm-hmm. you teach that you can assess it in. I keep it simple. I normally will do a sitting test, and I'll do a supine 3-month test, and depending on what their needs are, I will spend some time getting them to, if you think of that core, quote unquote core, where we're trying to optimize IAP as a CoCan, right? Your two diaphragms are top and bottom, and your abdominal wall is the can itself. Mm-hmm. Within IAP, simply put, I will look to undent the dents in the CoCan.
Mm.
Right?
I see.
And so that we have a uniform fill all through that abdominal wall.
Mm-hmm. What would be an example of an exercise you would use to go about that?
An exercise, I mean, really would be like a supported 3-month position. So okay. The person will be on their back. I'm going to have my one leg on the table. They're supporting their lower legs, right? Their shins.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to make sure that pelvis rib cage is good, that they're able to expand without relying upon the respiratory function of diaphragm to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, you know, in that position, I'm still supporting them, because really being able to hold the legs up is challenging if you don't have quality IAP.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking for the quality of the fill.
I see.
And then once I feel like the quality of the fill is somewhat good, I will ask them, I will slowly take away support, and I will see, can they keep the support duties to that core region? You'll see pecs turn on, you'll see necks turn on.
Yeah.
Right. You'll hear people talking about, oh, my hip flexors are cramping, right? So the amazing thing is having felt it firsthand myself, is that, you know, when you get someone to have good, high quality IAP, it's all just in the core. Neck is quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Support. The core is able to support the response to the demands. You know, for me, for the longest time, I was such a pec stabilizer, right?
In yeah.
Those positions, I would just lock up through my pecs.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's cool, because like those assessments, kind of like how you mentioned, when they walk in the door, you're assessing them. Even when I give someone an exercise, it's an assessment, and you can kind of see like how they compensate right away. Like if their neck kicks on in that position you just described, well, okay, maybe you're kicking on your accessory inspiration muscles a little bit too much than you probably should. So I think that's a good way of doing it. But the repositioning thing you said about the PRI going to the DNS things, I think that's an interesting observation. Do you think that also applies to FRS principles, FRC principles, when you go and you might do like some in-range work or whatever? Do you think it's better to potentially consider repositioning before that? Or do you think those principles apply regardless of that?
So from an absolute in a vacuum training standpoint,
mm-hmm.
I would say repositioning should always occur first.
I see.
But from a buy-in appreciation standpoint, you know, if someone comes in and they already know about cars and they're doing cars and they understand pails and rails and all those other things, I want them to make sure that they're getting the most out of that particular training stimulus, right? And so I already know, like, I already have some ideas as to how they might be compensating, how I might be able to change what they're doing, mm-hmm. so that they can get, you know, a different experience from the cars. Because cars themselves are incredible, right? In terms of the training stimulus, in terms of the feedback that you're able to get on yourself if you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And so when they come and if they have an issue, right, typically because of what we know in PRI, you're going to see issues at ball and socket internal rotation, shoulders and hips. Uh-huh. If that's something that they're that's their roadblock, then yeah, of course I'm going to go to the PRI stuff. But if they're trying to improve shoulder external rotation, shoulder extension, ankle dorsiflexion, obviously I'm going to be like, hey, let's figure out how we can add different training elements from FRC, right? Maybe, right? So that's where we'll go with that.
That makes sense. And that is one end of the spectrum. You see that these people that are restricted, they're compressed individuals who have a hard time getting into deeper ranges of motion. I think that's very valuable. Like, it's a great tool. Unfortunately, I see a lot of, I'm not even talking about these three systems. I'm talking about a lot of things, a lot of methods people use. They're working under the assumption that their skeleton is in a neutral position. And oftentimes that's not the case. So if you're going to try and have an adaptation occur, make a change within the body or work a joint in a certain position, I think it's important to understand that walking in the door, it's going to be very frequent that that person is not going to be in a neutral position. So I think respecting that first and taking that step can get much better results than just taking this person and then, okay, now I want you to, I don't know, you got deadlift pain, you got back pain on your deadlift, then maybe your skeleton didn't come in a very neutral position. Maybe we should address that first. Maybe that should be a consideration within the warm-up. Or maybe if we're trying to improve internal rotation, a lot of it's driven from your forward pelvis or torqued pelvis. So I think that's something that's really important to consider before we go in and get local with things. But ultimately, there is another end of the spectrum, which is these hypermobile individuals, these people that are very loosey-goosey, like I like to say. They're hard to control. And in my experience, I don't know about you, I find that they're harder. Like, frankly, they're a harder case to crack. And while it's not impossible, it is certainly a different approach that we need to take. So when it comes to these hypermobile people, these are like your patho PECs, for example. How do you address these people?
So from a PRI standpoint, right, these people that are hypermobile, mm-hmm. The one thing we know that is that they're not going to have any hamstrings at all, right? Both from a muscle physiology standpoint, but also from a sensory standpoint. And really, the biggest thing that I've taken away over the last few years from PRI with respect to patho PECs is that it's all about reference centers, right? Mm-hmm. But on the other end of the spectrum, FRS does a fantastic job getting these people to control those ranges, because really with all these hypermobile people, what you typically see is that there's a big divide, there's a big gap between what their movement potential is, meaning their passive ranges of motion, versus what they are actively able to compensate, right? Or actively able to control. Mm-hmm. And so within the FRS framework, they do have training ideas as to how to slowly bridge that gap. Right. I'm not a person who has big AP gaps. I mean, I barely have any passive range of motion to begin with. but for those people, that's really hard work, but it really pays off. And so, with those people, whereas I might stick them on, with other people, I might have them stay on a PRI routine a little bit longer and a little bit sooner into their program with patho PECs, depending on what their complaints are, right? When we do have a big gap in active to passive ratios in FRS, we're having them do a lot of positional isometrics. Mm-hmm. So they're getting both right off the bat. They're getting a ton of hamstring, oblique work, adductor work, mm-hmm. and they're getting a ton of positional isometrics for as it relates to what it is they want to do, right? What their demands are.
Let's say I have a pelvic femoral ligament laxity and my PA is all over the place. Yeah. What are some things other than like, you know, repositioning hamstring stuff? Like what is an example of a positional isometric you might give me if we're trying to control like external rotation, for example?
All right. So if you have someone who has a ton of passive external rotation, let's just say they can passively be taken by the operator or practitioner to say 90 degrees in a mm-hmm. supine position. And you ask them to actively do it. And after about 20 degrees, they start to invert that ankle. They start to flex that hip. They start to adduct. A positional isometric would simply, you know, what I would do is I would just take them to, you know, I would start them at 20 degrees, but then I would have them take them to 30, right? Mm-hmm. And tell them that they cannot come off this position. They would then use tensioning as taught in FRS. And then I would release and they would be forced to try to drive control at that range. And I would drive and change the positioning, maybe against gravity into 30 degrees, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I would teach them how to set up that 30 degree, 40 degree positional isometric on their own. And then not only do I have them train at that end range, right, of 30 degrees or 40 degrees, but I would also have them train where they start at zero, work up against gravity up to that 30, 40 degrees, and then slowly control that back out.
That's beautiful. Yeah. That's really cool. And you do use a similar approach for internal rotation as well?
Yes.
Got it. And just about any sort of like even shoulder external rotation?
Yes. So positional isometrics, you know, once again, even though, you know, there are more commonly seen quote unquote positions or activities you see in FRS, one of the big principles for them is that, hey, like there are no real FRC exercises, mm-hmm. just principles. And so positional isometric is the appropriate tool when you have a large active to passive gap.
Yeah. That's really cool. That's a tool that's really good to have in the box. What would be your advice to strength coaches, personal trainers, people that work with these hypermobile individuals? Would you say those isometrics are a really good way to control the ranges of motion, of course, but what are some other things you would say to that population?
I mean, really the question becomes, you know, I'll probably, you know, there's probably going to be some pushback, but I would say like, look, if the person does have hypermobility, right? Your job as a trainer is to make them move better. Mm-hmm. If the person now has a pain or symptomatic presentation, then, you know, then I think that's where you need to refer out to someone who's probably better handled to manage that. And so that's probably the first one is make sure, you know, just like not everyone who walks in my door is appropriate for PT. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, especially now with this movement within the PT world of direct access, you know, more and more people are coming to us directly, right? And that's all fine and dandy, but at the same time, just because you come see me doesn't mean that I'm the right person for you, right? So of course, you know, in my world, you know, I mean, my primary care physician absolutely loves me because, you know, I can't believe how many people come to me and they're like, oh yeah, you know, I haven't had a physical in like 5 years. I'm like, yeah, you probably need to have that done. Right. Mm. And then on that same end, with respect to, you know, if they need an orthopedic consult, right. I actually don't refer to any of the orthos in my city because I've seen their work. Right.
You know what they do.
I know what they do. Right. Yeah. And then I know who the good orthos are, right? The good orthos are the ones that are like, hey, like, you know, we can hold off on this. You need to go through all your conservative measures first. And mm-hmm. so, And so once again, I went off a little bit there, but it comes down to making sure that that person is appropriate for you, and to remove any ego and be like, hey, like there's something here that maybe I don't understand.
Yeah.
Right. Or that I'm not best suited for. Because really it's never about you. It's always about the person you're serving. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
that would be my words. Those would be my words to them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's very well said. And I think sometimes different people, not even just strength coaches and personal trainers, but a lot of people think they can fix things that are not within, you know, their scope. And I think the more I talk to people who work with people in pain a lot, the more I realize so much of pain is driven by cranial things, whether that's within your actual brain, with actual psychological things going on, trauma, childhood experiences, past experiences, or within the actual cranium itself and also the cervical region. So I guess a question for you would be something I've been wondering ever since I took the cervical course from PRI 2 weekends ago. I've been wondering how much of these issues are being driven. I wouldn't, because obviously it's a spectrum of top down versus bottom up, but ultimately, like so many of us have these people we just can't figure out. How much of this do you think is being driven from potential cranial and cervical influences? Clearly, it's individual.
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
I would say, gosh, I mean, if you really think about it, right? If you think about like how many people are out there, right? Mm-hmm. That can have a visual system issue affecting their body, right? That's absolutely gonna put a cap on your non-visual cranial outcomes, right? In principle, mm-hmm. I'm working on a shoulder. There's occlusion, right? There's hearing. There's two different nostrils, right? With sinus passages. There's a tongue, right? I mean, there's all these different things, and then at the same time, there's all, like you said, all the emotional stuff that we have to think about. So, you know, it's one of those things where, like, if you're dealing with a quote unquote musculoskeletal issue at the knee or whatever, I liken it to like it's a parking brake, right? And so it can affect your program. The question is how much of that parking brake is still on?
I see.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there have been instances where, you know, it's like, well, yeah, this person has like a -8, you know, prescription in their glasses, but the optometrist they're working with has done a great job of not overcorrecting them. And mm-hmm. so they're able to progress with their program fine. And then there are other people. One of my cases before the whole outbreak was, you know, I had someone who I really didn't think anything of it. He had a 0.75 correction. And it was one of those things where we were running into this brick wall. And then, you know, one day he mentioned he forgot his glasses during a workout. He's like, oh, yeah, you know, my shoulder felt so much better during the workout. I was like, okay, so, you know, let's explore that a little bit more, right? And so he came into clinic the next time, and we did all our tests with and without his glasses, because normally he comes in, came in with contacts, yeah. Right? So we had that go on.
How does that work? How does the visual system, like, how can someone put on glasses and all of a sudden their shoulder feels better during the workout? Like, what is the, do you feel confident on, like, explaining how the vision is going to affect those outcomes in the shoulder? I don't know if that's too loaded of a question.
I'll try my best. How about that?
Sure, sure.
So I would say that, you know, ultimately our brain wants safety, right? Safety is like the biggest thing that our brain ultimately wants. And I think my interpretation is that, you know, some of these default patterns that we go into, these patterns for stability, right? The left AIC, right BC pattern is a mm-hmm. pattern of stability, because that's what we're defaulted with, which will present, you know, as limited HGIR on the right, limited horizontal abduction on the left, you know, up in the neck, right? You've got your cervical tests. If our eyes are providing our brain with a faulty matrix and the brain doesn't, it doesn't reconcile, it's going to want to find something to hang on to. It's kind of like my, two-year-old, my clingy two-year-old, right? You know, he's a lot more clingy, than my oldest one is. Yeah. But that's the system that he lives with, right? That he lives in. And so, hopefully I didn't butcher that too much, but
no, I think that makes sense.
Yeah. You know, and then of course, like the power of what, the optometrist is trying to do with the prescription. The funniest thing is that when I took the vision course, is that within the world of optometry, apparently there are three main schools of thought, and every single one of them thinks the other is wrong.
Right? It's funny how that works, isn't it?
Right. And so once again, you know, that is why, just because you've seen an optometrist doesn't mean that the glasses you have or the prescriptions you have are ideal for you, at least with respect to, from a PRI standpoint.
Yeah. I think the whole stability thing is so key. Like ultimately, no matter what your problem is and where you come from or where you're going, I think there's two main consistent themes within the body, and that's the brain wants stability and the body wants to expend the least amount of calories for the most amount of results. And I think that's ultimately, if you understand those two things, then you understand how, ooh, wow, you're defaulting into this position. Well, that's probably because that's the position where you can do both of those things the best. And all of a sudden, like after that, things become much easier when you look at it at a human being. And you touched on something that I think we didn't plan on talking about this, but I think this is a cool rabbit hole to go down. And that is when you look at these different, different professions, I guess, for lack of a better term right now. You've got physical therapists, you've got doctors, you've got orthopedic surgeons, you have all these things. And I've noticed the more that I work with people that have gone to see doctors for their pain, surgery is a very common thing. And I've seen, I saw a quote the other day that said, it was from some physical therapist on a board of something that sounded important. And it was like, 99% of people don't need surgery. The ones that do get surgery didn't have a good enough physical therapist. Do you agree with that statement?
No. Because there are, I mean, let's think about trauma, right?
Yeah.
You've got a compound fracture that requires orthopedic intervention.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Right.
You got to do it. Yeah.
Right. In terms of like ACL tears, I mean, I've personally in my career, I've had six people that I've taken through a course of care where they didn't have their knee reconstructed, right? They didn't want to go through the surgery, and we were able to get them back to sport, back to life. But once again, you know, I'm going to be completely honest. Some of those people, you know, those people gave up a part of whatever it is that they were doing before, but for them, they also understood, they made that decision within themselves that they weren't going to go back to that activity. Right. So, you know, if you've torn an ACL and you're a professional basketball player and your livelihood, right, depends on you having an intact ACL, I don't think all the physical therapy in the world is going to be enough.
Okay. Yeah. That's obviously, yeah, I agree with that. What about people? And by the way, I don't have a side here. I'm just picking someone's brain. That's very smart. Someone that has non-acute, just like back pain or non-acute shoulder pain, but it's dramatic. It's pretty significant. And then they take an MRI and they've got disc degeneration or they have a rotator cuff tear, but at the end of the day, so do I, and maybe so do you. Do you think that how much weight do you put in an MRI and then how that affects what you go about treating someone?
To be completely honest, the amount of weight that I put on an MRI Depends on the orthopedic surgeon that is interpreting those results for the patient.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the ugly secrets about the world of orthopedics is that people in this day and age will surgeon shop. So, for example,
really,
so someone has determined that they need a hip scope, mm-hmm. right, on their own, Dr. Google, right? They've determined, or you know, hip pain message board, right?
Yeah,
they need a hip scope. And if they go to this one doc and the doc's like, no, I'm not going to do it, they're just going to fire that doc and go find someone else. And, you know, there are very good docs who are like, hey, like, I did the right thing, but now I'm being punished financially. I'm being punished, you know, reputation wise, so on and so forth. And so now maybe it's one of those things where they're being asked to, you know, to make a decision of like, well, you know, that person's going to get it anyways.
Right? I see.
But the other crazy thing with respect to, you know, let's say spine issues, right? Mm-hmm. So the incidence of low back pain in the U.S. is pretty much the same as with every other quote unquote westernized nation.
Mm-hmm.
But the incidence of back surgery is about 3 to 3.5 times higher in the U.S. And that's simply because of how spine surgeons are reimbursed in the U.S.
Incentive. Right?
So, you know, so in Australia, they actually, because it's a nationalized system, they actually stopped paying for spine fusion in certain cases because they know the outcomes are terrible, right? But for whatever reason here in the U.S., you know, there's a little bit of the culture too, right? Like the orthopedic world is probably the most bro-y, if you will, of all the medical professions, right?
Yeah.
So everyone's, you know, talking about who's driving what, right? Who's doing numbers, right? Yeah. So on and so forth. And so unfortunately, you know, maybe that doesn't lead to the best environment for someone who does have a back issue and they're looking for what their best option is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we take a step back and look at that bird's eye view of really what's going on with respect to these things in our medical world, you know, I just don't see it. I don't see the reasoning for spine surgery in a majority of cases. Same for shoulders. I mean, you know, there are, right, standards of practice, but yet I'll still see outcomes, post-operative outcomes of situations where, you know, maybe these things weren't warranted, and even the AAOS will say so, right?
Yeah. Have you seen the studies that say, I think they did placebo fake surgeries on some people and they did real surgeries on others. And the people that had placebo surgeries had just as good, if not in some cases better, outcomes of perceived pain after their healing process was completed. Yep. You ever seen those?
Yep. I've seen that.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, so I'm old enough to remember subacromial decompressions from the early 90s, mm-hmm. right? So back when I first, you know, even when I was an intern, when I was an aide, subacromial decompressions were like the big things, right? You had impingement, you know, the idea was that you didn't, your quote unquote ceiling wasn't high enough, so they would just, you know, go shave off all that bone.
Yeah.
And then finally, after 25 years, so right around, you know, I want to say the study came out in like 2014, 2015, they did a meta-analysis and they're like, oh yeah, these outcomes are terrible. So we don't recommend subacromial decompressions anymore.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing a repeat of that with hip FAI surgeries.
Right? See those a lot.
Yep. Cause, you know, I think if you go back to like 2009, there isn't even a mention of FAI in the literature. And then in 10, you see like three or four studies, and then it just exponentially grows after that.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, you get these people who are like, yeah, I'm a sports med guy, but I'm going to go, you know, to a 5-day training, and now I'm doing hip scopes.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. That is amazing. The FAI thing, like if you just look at it, what FAI is and how the surgery works and like just what it is in general, you quickly realize like, wait, why can't I just, you know, why can't I just change the influence the pelvic orientation? Why can't I just influence the femoral orientation? And why wouldn't that take care of just as many things as the surgery is trying to accomplish? You know what I mean?
I still get exposed every now and then to interns from a friend of mine who has a medical practice. And I tell all the interns, I'm like, hey man, if you go into orthopedic surgery, don't do hips. Right?
Yeah.
You're not doing the right thing there. Right?
It's tough. Yeah.
And I'm also probably getting into a lot of trouble for this, but I also feel the same way about physiatry.
Oh wow.
Physical medicine.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
But that's what I see every single day.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And you got to take the word from the people who have been there and they see this on the other side, like you have. I think that's important to consider that. I think this takes us down the hole of when it comes to pain and addressing pain. Something I've really paid attention to hard this year is when I work with people and I see their history. I talk about what surgery they've had, their exercise history. I see what makes them click in terms of what they feel has worked for them. Whether or not on like a physical reality sense it has or not, that's a different story. But I find that if you think about the biopsychosocial pain model and how it relates to what you genuinely believe is going to be better for you, that is actually probably going to result in better outcomes for you as per the placebo of surgeries. So if you believe the surgery is going to have a massive impact on you and you go in, well, maybe it will, more so than if you didn't and you're reluctant. So I think when it comes to the biopsychosocial pain model and as it relates to kind of incorporating all these systems with DNS, PRI, FRS, ultimately I was talking to actually Dr. Ben House yesterday about this, like this could be us just believing so much in what we do and the outcomes that we achieve that the patient or the client, they sense this energy that we're feeding off and they recognize what we're doing is different. And then they could be more inclined to be bought into our practices because they find that, well, wow, this guy really is doing something different and he really does care about me. So maybe this is a good environment for me to get more parasympathetic in or for me to downregulate my autonomic nervous system so much. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, you know, when you think of the interaction between a patient or a client and the provider, what the person who is the client patient that presents in front of you, how they're presenting, that is such the tip of the iceberg. And what's going on within them, you know, underneath the water, that's why a history, and not only just the history, but getting them comfortable enough to really reveal things because you know, I'm working with a pro soccer player. And when he told me his history, I'm like, okay, that's fine. You know, so on and so forth. And then like, we just had our second telehealth session. It's like, oh yeah, by the way, I forgot. I've had, you know, 12 shots, you know, into my pubic symphysis groin region. And I was like,
gosh,
oh yeah, that might've been important to know. Right.
Yeah.
So part of it, right, is obviously what they're willing to tell you. There are some things that people are embarrassed to tell you about, right? They don't trust you enough yet.
Yeah.
And some of it is the questioning skills of the practitioner. And then, of course, one of the other things that really helps set up for success is like your intake forms, right? Mm. So I set up my intake forms that, you know, I'm like, hey, take your sweet time here, right? I want to lay it out all out. And so, you know, from there, it comes down to the practitioner playing detective. And so, you know, no one is ever really just a shoulder case, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, in some instances, the shoulder is the majority of the glacier, mm-hmm. right? And in some cases, the shoulder is really just the tip of the iceberg, right?
Yeah.
And so that's really where we need to figure out, you know, within the biopsychosocial model, how can we let this person have closure with all these other things that might be, I don't want to say artificially, but, you know, lowering the ceiling on their outcome potential.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing to dig underneath the hood and see what's going on. I find that, a lot of times, like I have a client that I was talking to this morning, for example, he's a mess. He has a lot of compensations built up, super hypermobile. That's what sparked that question earlier. Now I find that this individual really struggles to not overthink about his pain. He's constantly sending me messages about like, hey, you know, this position didn't feel optimal on my back, this hinge pattern, this squat, blah, blah, blah. And then I just told him like, hey man, like, I think you just might be thinking a lot. And if you think this much about what you're doing and you're overanalyzing, it's kind of, not only is it paralysis by analysis, but you're probably just feeding your brain. You're giving it more of an incentive to be aware of that area that's painful. So if you keep thinking about it, then you're just going to probably feel it more. And I don't know the exact mechanisms behind that, but I would tell you that in my experience, that's what I see time and time again. Do you find that these people that tend to be in a lot of pain, they like almost make an identity out of it? It's part of who they are, and it's hard for them to necessarily like let go of that and to kind of relax almost. It's like a nervous system thing.
Yes. And one of the things that, for whatever reason, is almost my gift in a weird way. My front desk will tell you this, because in my clinic, my front desk, they're about, oh, I don't know, 15, 20 feet away from where my main table is. Mm-hmm. I'm usually good for about one or two cries per week, meaning I'm able to get, you know, I will usually have someone cry on me once or twice a week. And I think really, you know, I don't get that from being a dick, right? Yeah. I get it from, you know, having people really come face to face with some of the things that I think they're trying to bury, or some of the things that they're lying to themselves about. You know, I'm not even close to anything sort of a mental health professional, but you know, when you understand how much power this brain has over the rest of the physical body, you know, I just have to make sure that we give ourselves a chance to be successful with our relationship. And yeah, that's where getting people to, I guess, come face to face with it.
Yeah.
Gives them the chance to be like, okay, like, I'm not going to get anywhere. And maybe I am making this a big part of my identity. And so, you know, what do I want to make my identity moving forward? How do I want to continue writing this book? Because up to this point, you know, if you think of life as a book, right, your chapters up to this point have led to this, to your character, the main character, you, mm-hmm. this is where you're at in your book, right? And so,
yeah,
you know, you as the author, you know, you have to understand that you have the power, to figure out how you're going to progress this character through the rest of the book.
That's a great metaphor. I love that we're talking about this too, because this is so much of what both you and I do. And unfortunately, I don't know why in school I didn't take any psychology classes, or it wasn't required for me to take any behavioral psychology classes, but that's easily half my job. So I think it's important to recognize these things and talk about them, because maybe, like, for this person, if we're talking about stability through the brain, maybe their stability is to be in pain. Maybe right. That's like what they're holding on to. And it's hard to let go of that, even though that's what they desperately want.
That's their quote unquote reference center.
Yeah. The reference center is pain. Yeah. That's amazing. That's such an interesting thought. Yeah. Well, cool, man. Hey, I appreciate you coming on today. This was a really great conversation. Where can people find you on social media?
The best way is through my Instagram, at Dr. Lok Rao, DrLocRao. You know, once again, through this quarantine time, I'm working towards launching my site. So I can start capturing some emails.
Yeah. You have anything coming up? Anything exciting?
I'm working on a seminar, which is going to be an in-person seminar. Mm. I'm working on an in-person seminar. And I'm also working on a couple of different online, platforms. I've got one that I think is unique to the entire field. Nice. I think. And when that launches, I'll let everybody know.
Yeah. Well, you have a really unique perspective, and I think people really like what you do. So that's awesome. I can't wait to hear more about that.
Yeah. Hey, thank you so much. This was a really enjoyable conversation. I have so much more appreciation for you just because now we've had the chance to live chat.
Likewise, man. Thank you. Thank you for your time, and we'll have to do this again soon.
All right. Have a great day.
You too, man.